Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to today's Council on Foreign Relations, Religion and Foreign Policy conference call. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org. We are delighted to have Robert Cruz with us today to discuss the religious makeup of Russia, as well as recent developments in the region. Robert Cruz is director of the Abbasi Program in Islamic Studies and associate professor of history at Stanford University. He is the author of For Profit and Tsar, Islam and Empire in Russia and Central Asia, as well as numerous book chapters and articles. Dr. Cruz holds multiple degrees, including a PhD from Princeton University. Dr. Cruz, thanks very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could give us an overview of the ethnic tensions in Russia and what you see happening given the recent annexation of Crimea and how it will affect the region.
Great. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the Council for Relations for inviting me, and thank all of you for calling in and taking the time to discuss this with me. I look forward to your questions and comments. Maybe I'll just make three initial points as a kind of overview in about 10 minutes or so, and then open up the floor. First, I guess, I mean, as a historian, it might be appropriate to start with a sense of the context, or to suggest a context for interpreting what have been a series of events in the last month or two, which I think no one really has been able to predict. I've yet to hear a political scientist or think tank strategist claim credit for what they've seen between Kiev and Moscow, from Yanukovych's flight to the annexation of Crimea. All this stuff is something that many of us, you know, in the field of Russian East European Eurasian studies had thought about in the early 1990s, but had largely dismissed, having, we thought, kind of moved on from any of these possibilities. So I begin with a caveat that I think we're all somewhat in shock about this and still trying to process what is happening and what might happen next. So if you bear with me, I think if I could offer a brief snapshot of the context, I think that would be helpful for us. I think I would begin by looking at this from the South, that is, looking at it from the Middle East, from, if you'd like, the Muslim world, which I know is a crude generalization. But if we look at it from a kind of global view, I think we gain a vantage point from which we might critique some of the commonsensical explanations that have been on offer, especially in the American media, about why Putin has done what he's done and why Crimea has taken shape the way it has. I suppose I would put the accent on geopolitics as an explanation. I would dismiss comparisons to Hitler and Stalin, to the you know, Hitler's annexation of the Sudetenland. This is not a kind of replay of any of those historical narratives. I'd also dismiss claims that, you know, Putin is totally out of touch, that he's lost his mind, or even that this is some kind of imperial revenge, that this is an episode of some kind of Orthodox Christian messianism, that Putin is, you know, living in the past, that he, you know, is totally divorced from reality, or any of these kinds of claims that have been put with much emotion kind of on our television screens especially. Instead, I think the operative context, which I think might frame our discussion, is that this is for me ultimately a moment of realpolitik in which the Kremlin has finally drawn a line in the sand over what we might call the post-2003 decay of the international order. And here, of course, this means taking in other actors into view, including the United States. And here, I think the Iraq story and, in general, the expansion and the more, I guess, lengthy story of NATO expansion all the way to, as they would put it, the Kremlin people might put it, the gates of Moscow, really, through Kiev. All this, I think, informs why Putin acted the way he did. I think, actually, he clarified his position a great deal. Having played coy about a number of issues, he finally, I think, laid bare why he did what he's done in his speech yesterday when he announced the annexation of Crimea. It's, you know, his conclusion, the way he put it, is, a, you know, Crimea returning home to a safe port. This is very much done in the context of America and NATO's place in the world. In fact, we see many Russian commentators, not just Putin, seeing the Maidan uprising, Yanukovych's flight, all the events of Kiev through really a global lens. They've seen it as a contest between, really a contest about American power in the world. And I suggest that that's how we think about Syria, Russia and Iran, and a whole host of issues. So obviously Ukraine's part of the mix. We can discuss this topic. I mean, there's a longstanding...
With the White House?
Ambivalence among Russian intellectuals.
They were like, can you hear us loud and clear? I was like,
the legitimacy of anything like a Ukrainian nation. That's a longstanding...
In front of everybody?
Point of debate. And I recall even back in the day with my language teachers in Petersburg having intense disputes with them about whether or not Ukrainians even exist, right? Whether or not they're just kind of
Dan Mudd
Russians. And we see in 2014 that idea is still very much contested. So again, this is a way, if I'm correct, what I'm suggesting is that Putin has responded with force in the manner that he has because he understands the international system to permit such actions, and that he sees the Americans as establishing all the precedents that allow him to operate in the way that he feels necessary to, by his understanding, protect his neighborhood, protect his protection of power, and ultimately protect his political system. Right? I think he sees a kind of domino theory in play, which just goes back to Kremlin's responses to all the so-called color revolutions. And here, of course, the Orange Revolution of 2004 in Ukraine is the most relevant. So that's a long way of saying, to my mind, Putin is acting in a way that is logical, it makes sense. It is illegal, according to many understandings of the law, and I would support that view, but given the state of international affairs today, there are many points. I think there's a logic to what he's arguing, and there's a logic to his actions as an aggressive statement of parity with the actions of the United States and NATO power. And again, we can find many examples that Putin has cited, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya, to Syria and beyond, to help make his case. So having said that, I think what really at the heart of what I want to touch on today is really that this sets up a number of opportunities and perils for the Russian state and for the region more generally. Of course, the Kremlin is celebrating this as a great achievement, a great restoration of Russian imperial might. And of course, they see this through a deep historical lens. But it also creates major dilemmas. Starting, of course, with relations with the United States and Europe. Many economic questions remain about sanctions and where the Russian economy will fit into global markets in the wake of the Crimean annexation. But for me, I think what's most striking is that Russia now faces a real dilemma, and that it now has to integrate this new space, Crimea, which it last formally integrated in the late 18th century under Catherine the Great, formally in 1783. And like Catherine, what Putin faces is the challenge of integrating a very substantive Muslim population. So what has begun is a kind of great power struggle, a project for some about Europe, about competing nationalities, and so on, is now very much an issue relating to Islam. It's very much now about Islam because there's some 300,000 Muslims in the Crimea. A word about this population. They are, as you all know very well already, they're distinctive because these communities, primarily the Crimean Tatars, have a very tortured history under Soviet rule, indeed under imperial rule going back to the 18th century. And as you know, you've read again and again that Stalin deported, probably exterminated a large portion of this population and deported the rest wholesale in 1944 on suspicion of collaboration with the Nazis. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, some 300,000 have returned to the Crimean Peninsula, but there remains a large Crimean Tatar diaspora in Russia and Central Asia and throughout the states of the former Soviet Union. But looking more closely at this community with a very, very tortured history, with a very strong sense of grievance, if you look at their publications, they claim that the victims of genocide. Their perspective is quite interesting because the Crimean Tatar elite has mostly sided with the Ukrainian revolutionaries, that is, those who went on to the Maidan and who opposed Yanukovych, those who are constituting the government in Kiev today. And yet, if we follow the story before the tumult of the last couple months, the Crimean Tatars were not fully happy under Ukraine either. There were lots of unfulfilled promises about restoring land, about restoring their what they would regard to be their full civil rights, about restoring what they imagine to be the proper place for Islam in the Crimean Peninsula, partly, many of the politicians will tell you now, because they face strong opposition from the Russian majority of the peninsula. So this is yet another instance, which connects my first point, that this isn't, in my mind, a kind of black-and-white story that Ukraine was good for the Crimean Tatars and Russia will be bad for them. I think, in fact, it's quite messy, and the Crimean Tatars have had much to object to under either the Ukrainian or now the future Russian scenarios. But a word more about Crimea. Part of the challenge of integrating these new populations, what will that involve? What would that look like? First, they make up some 12% of the population of the peninsula, but they have strong backers across the sea in Turkey, where there's also a large Tatar diaspora. And here I think this will be something that will, as in other parts of Russia, make Russia's politics policies toward these Muslim populations part of its foreign policy. That is, it'll be very hard to separate domestic and foreign policy in Crimea. The other major concern, the most pressing concern in the short term, is, of course, the state of ethnic relations on the peninsula. Nearly all of the Crimean Tatars appear to have boycotted the referendum on the 16th. Perhaps 1,000 or more voted, according to the Crimean Tatar leadership. The Russians claim that more voted to legitimize the new dispensation. But there are clearly tensions between Russians and Crimean Tatars at this moment. There have been a few disappearances of Crimean Tatar kind of activists, some of that is being followed in the Muslim press throughout the former Soviet Union. And there's some alarm about the activities of kind of far-right Russian activists there, including Cossacks and some of the biker gangs who descended in advance of the Russian troops on the Crimea to claim it for Russia. So there's enormous potential, and the Crimean Tatar elite is very aware of the potential for provocation, for any kind of acts that would lead to kind of collective violence between the Crimean Tatar and Russian communities. So that's the worrying context in the short term for the Kremlin and, of course, the people living in Crimea. To say nothing of the Ukrainian right, which has its own views in Kiev and in the eastern parts of Ukraine, to which we can turn later. The last point, having touched on the geopolitical context and then this challenge of integrating this sizable Muslim population into Russia's already enormous Muslim population and the rest of the Russian Federation. The third point I'd like to make is that, in fact, this integration is already taking place in a very interesting way. And if you looked at the foreign affairs piece that I think was distributed earlier, many of the actors who appear in that piece are already active in Crimea, already working roughly in concert with the Kremlin to achieve the integration of these potentially new Russian Muslim populations. So we've seen already numerous delegations staffed by Muslim clerics from Moscow, from Tatarstan, from elsewhere, arguing on two grounds. The first, that these people are, in effect, they're Muslim. They're co-religionists. They share the same faith. But they also, that the other intangible bond, which we see being offered a great deal in this context, is the idea that these are also co-ethnics. That is, they're also Tatars. Now, this is disputed in interesting ways because each of the kind of Tatar communities of the Russian Federation in Eurasia, though they speak a more or less mutually intelligible Turkic language, and though they have many historical linkages, each has its own distinctive history and identity. And the Crimean Tatar is very distinctive, having been stamped by Stalinist repression in a way that Tatars elsewhere in the Russian Empire and Soviet Union never faced. What links my article to the Crimean story now is that we see, as in Russian domestic policies, we see Russian clerics working in concert with the Kremlin to attempt to integrate these new communities in Crimea. We see a very strong argument that many of these figures have made to the effect that Islam will be better under Russian rule, and it will be better principally because it will be policed in the way that it's being policed in the rest of the Russian Federation. That is, we see the accusation that the Ukrainian leadership was too laissez-faire, that they weren't careful enough in weeding out so-called sects, that is, sectarian groups, that they're too permissive toward groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is the kind of pan-Islamic underground organization operating throughout the space, but globally, and that they've been too lax toward so-called Wahhabis, that is, people who might be coming to the space with a kind of Salafist orientation inspired by Arab thinkers, especially Saudi thinkers, outside of Crimea, outside of Ukraine, outside of Russia. So a number of Russian clerics have come forward and say that this is a very positive development, not just for Russia, but for Islam, because these populations will now be integrated into a proper Islamic kind of hierarchy. They'll be properly integrated into a leadership structure that actually knows how to distinguish pure from false interpretations of Islam, and that under this proper religious leadership, Crimean Tatars can expect a wonderful future. In the meantime, Putin very explicitly in his speech yesterday said that, you know, he meant to address all the concerns of the Crimean Tatars, and he said explicitly that he would provide all the rights that the Ukrainians had ostensibly denied, and had actually denied the Crimean Tatars in the period from 1991 to the present. First among them was the elevation of the Crimean Tatar language to a national language, that is an official language, that is a state language. Putin has promised this. He's also promised to complete the process of rehabilitation, that is, to complete the process of erasing all the stigma and all the disabilities that came with the Stalinist repression in 1944, to restore their old property rights, to restore their, you know, complete citizenship, and somehow make amends for the repression of the Stalin period. Here, Putin was a bit cagey, though, because he said that, you know, everyone suffered. He immediately diluted that statement of sympathies to a degree by saying that, you know, lots of ethnic groups had suffered under Stalin, no one more than the Russians. So Putin is very careful to, in this case, to speak to multiple audiences. And finally, Putin argued that he would allow the civic organizations, of which there are two main ones in Crimea that represent or claim to represent the Tatars, that he would work to elevate them to the status of state institutions, that he would somehow integrate these civil society organizations into state structures in a way that would benefit the Crimean Tatars. All based on the assertion that these things were denied, the Crimean Tatars under Ukraine and under Russia, they're not only being restored to their historical home in a way, but now they will be under a better rights regime, that they'll have language, they'll have religion, they'll have a new kind of political autonomy. To date, as of the 19th, the Crimean Tatar leadership is very skeptical about these claims, but is kind of waiting to see what will happen. But what strikes me about this is that we see Putin's Muslim allies operating much the way they have elsewhere in the Russian Federation in this new space and working to integrate Crimea into the Russian Federation in ways that obviously benefit the Kremlin, but which play into the existing institutional and personal rivalries among some of these clerics. So we ask, we can't ask, you know, what's in it for them? I mean, they're doing the Kremlin's work, but they're also arguably struggling over the control of 300,000 new co-religionists, potentially, who might pay religious taxes, who might offer more legitimacy to their claims to be, you know, the prime leaders of the primary leaders of the Muslim community in Russia as a whole. So that's a long way of saying there's a lot going on. It unfortunately has come together in the last few days to make more sense, I think. There's clearly now a path forward that the Kremlin has laid, and Islam will play a very significant role in this alongside these very important ethnic divisions. So let me pause there, and I will be eager to take any questions or hear any comments you might have. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Bob. Let us open it up now to questions and comments from the group. And as a reminder, the discussion is on the record, and we did circulate in advance Bob's piece in Foreign Affairs, which I hope you've all had a chance to take a look at. So let's open up to questions.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Please limit your questions to one at a time. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from Donald Frew with the Covenant of the Goddess.
Hi, thank you very much for this talk. It's fascinating. I'm curious, the Native Faith Movement is the name given to the resurgence of traditional pagan religion in the Ukraine and is estimated to have about 95,000 followers, especially in the provinces around Crimea. On the one hand, such groups tend to be nationalist. On the other, they're not terribly welcomed by either the Orthodox or the Muslims. How would such groups be affected by the annexation of Crimea in terms of religious liberty?
Thank you for the question. It's an important one. I'm afraid I'm not obviously an expert on those communities or that material at all, but I think if we judge from Russian policy to date, if we look at how the Kremlin and its religious partners and various confessions have operated, there's a very strong agreement across the board, across the faith, from the Jews to even some of the non-Orthodox Christian groups, that there's a very limited space for toleration. And the parameters are more or less worked out by reference to, the history of the community's relationship to the Russian state. So Islam fits a certain category because it enjoys the status of a traditional religion. But all these new things and things that have come, different Christian movements that have come post-1991, or perhaps what you're describing, are much more vulnerable. I think, as I understand it, Ukraine has given a little more space to these groups, but I think we could expect a tightening up under the direction of the Kremlin, in part because it permits latitude, but only within certain channels. So there is latitude within Islam, within Judaism, but for anything that doesn't fit these categories, it doesn't fit the status of an historical Russian faith, then there could be potentially trouble. But I think a lot, I mean, to add another caveat, a lot may depend upon the positions of their local neighbors, right? So, will there be an Orthodox bishop who will want to, quote unquote, clean that up, or will want to address that in an aggressive fashion? And will that be the position of one of these, potentially, if the Crimean Tatar Muslims are integrated into a hierarchical structure that looks north, might they also be a target? I think a lot will depend upon a kind of confluence of policy in the center, and then I assume the initiative of local actors. But I think all this will take place, I think, somewhat gradually. I know we've moved very quick from the last week, I think much quicker than I would have ever imagined. But I think I imagine the Kremlin will slow down now, though. I think they'll have to be very careful in actually fully integrating all these institutions into a kind of all-Russian system. So I think that there will be some time to sort all this out, but I think a lot will probably depend upon local initiative.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Catherine Cosman with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
Hello. Thank you very much for your talk. I'm curious about Mustafa Jamiliev and that fascinating invitation to meet with Putin, and that he turned it down in favor of a phone call, and how he relates to how Jamiliev also relates to the younger generation.
Yeah, thank you. So she's referring to a very famous Crimean Tatar dissident who made the restoration of the rights of the Crimean Tatars a major civil rights issue in Soviet times, and has reemerged, and who has been working the kind of back channel circuit from the fall, attempting to represent the interests of the Crimean Tatars in Russia and Ukraine. I just read an interview with him describing that conversation with Putin and describing his conversation with a very important leader of Tatarstan, Matemir Shamiev. And he was very cautious. I guess what struck me was I think there's a wait-and-see attitude. And I think that paradoxically, I think the Kremlin could go quite a way to ameliorate some of the concerns of the Crimean Tatars if they were to concede the rights that Putin has promised in those most recent speeches. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think, again, if one read interviews with some of the Crimean Tatar leadership before the Maidan events, they were quite critical of Kiev. And one shouldn't, again, think in black and white terms. So it may be paradoxically that, you know, if the Putin regime is careful, they may actually come to some agreement with them. And I think that's partly, and the Korean Tatar leadership is being cautious. I think someone like the figure you mentioned is waiting to see how it will pan out. It's hard to say from the outside. You know, it looks as if there is a cohesive Korean Tatar leadership, but I doubt that. I think you suggested there might be a generational divide. I think that's very plausible. Certainly, on the religious front, among clerics, among the different kind of clerical organizations, there's definitely a difference of views, and that's true more broadly in Ukraine. There were some that appear to have looked to Moscow well before the events of Maidan, and some who argued for a totally apolitical stance. So I think that most of the Crimean Tatar leadership that we know about, you know, is very nationalist. I mean, they're very committed to nationalist mobilization, and we can't assume perhaps that all Koreans are as devoted to that cause as the leadership is.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from John Palakowski with the Catholic Theological Union.
Obviously, as you go back on something you just mentioned, you said that if one Orthodox bishop were to, stand up and make some positive contribution, might change the situation. But the question for me is, given the divisions between the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church, even in the Ukraine, how do you see that internal Orthodox conflict as relating to this situation? Is the Russian Orthodox Church, even that part that's in the Ukraine, supportive of the Crimean annexation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I unfortunately have not touched on that question at all here. I mean, there are many ways one could analyze this whole crisis through the lens of the Catholic Orthodox division.
I'm not thinking so much about the Catholic Orthodox as the internal Orthodox divisions.
Sure, I must confess that's beyond what I've been able to ascertain so far. But I guess if I may offer a very brief provisional answer. Sure. I mean, first there's a question of what we can know. I think there are. I mean, it's probably a question I have about some of the Muslim clerical organizations because, they are hierarchical, and I suspect there's often a greater difference of opinion within them. But what can be spoken about is limited, right? So I think that I've had colleagues who've made very important, reports recently about the internal heterogeneity of the Orthodox Church today in Russia, and have pointed to a kind of breadth of theological difference, which is quite striking. But unfortunately, what often comes to the surface is the more narrow state-centered patriotic viewpoint. So I think again, I'm just off the top of my head, I think that I can imagine that the senior leadership is very much in sync with Putin, but there could be very important regional differentiations, and very much it could look quite different on the ground among local communities. I've said that, though. I think the Crimean Russian population, I assume the local priests are in tune with their local constituencies, and that they are on board with this more general upsurge in Russian nationalism there. But that's just a kind of conjecture.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Marina Bulharmika, and she is a private consultant.
Yes, good afternoon. I am going to ask an economic question, and it's partly because in the early 1990s, I worked at that back end of the Black Sea, so I'm very familiar with the Kerch Peninsula and with the Crimea, and we were trying to put in an LP gas export facility just the other side of Timruk, south of the Sea of Azov. And so I've been trying to follow and find out what it is that enables the Crimea to survive and thrive economically. And I've been trying to see if Russia is offering anything to those people in terms of an advancement of the development of their economy. And can Russia do more with the gas exports and things from the Crimea? Do you have any sense of what's going on there? Because nothing's ever said in the press on it.
Sure. No, I think actually there have been some interesting pieces in foreign affairs that have touched on this subject by scholars who know far more than I. But I think if I understand the situation correctly from those pieces, under Ukraine or under Russia, the Crimea remains a so-called deficit region, one that has to be subsidized by a central budget one way or another, because it simply doesn't have the economy. And others have suggested that Ukraine may not miss it at all because it's this rust belt and it's hopeless. That's why this is yet another dimension to the kind of peril and promise that the Putin regime has created for itself in annexing Crimea. On the one hand, it's a great geopolitical achievement by their reckoning. On the other hand, they've inherited and will have to integrate this space with this economic pathology, right?
No one has really done anything with the ability to export from their gas and oil, and no one has really developed that the way they could.
I'm sure you know better than I, but there's vast potential given the geography and the history of the ways in which the Black Sea was knitted together for trade. But that remains a challenge. But strikingly, one thread that ties several of these issues together is a very audacious offer that the Kremlin-friendly head of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov, made just a few days ago. He promised that the new Crimea, he'll help subsidize Crimea as well. So it was coming from all sides, and that was meant to be meaningful from the Chechen leader because it was, on the one hand, an expression of Muslim solidarity, and the other, a reassurance that, or a kind of promise to Crimean citizens that, under Russia, their economic situation will improve greatly. Much of that depends, of course, on the fate of the Russian economy and whether or not sanctions have any effect, and I guess more broadly, what happens between Russia, Ukraine, and the EU.
Thank you.
Just to pick up on Bob's point, the Council publishes Foreign Affairs, which comes out every other month, but there is daily content on the website, foreignaffairs.com, and they have many, many resources on Ukraine and Russia. They've been following it quite closely. Bob wrote an article for Foreign Affairs, is posting a response, I think, soon, right, Bob?
Yes.
He'll be posting a response. So I encourage you to go there to look for more resources on and analysis on Russia and the Ukraine. So with that, let me go back now to the next question or comment.
Our next question comes from Jonathan Stein with the Charest Tefilia, and I apologize for the mispronunciation.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your presentation. The Jewish community has been following events partially with an eye to the rise of anti-Semitism in the Ukraine. There has not been some resurgence of it on a major level, but apparently a few isolated incidents. However, yesterday, one of the translations of President Putin's speech, which I read, included him saying that anti-Semitism in the Ukraine was one of the reasons for taking over the Crimea. And I'm wondering if you would comment.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, that's a moment rich in irony coming from Putin. But nonetheless, I think this is where I would differ from much of the media coverage so far. I mean, Putin has painted all of the opponents of Yanukovych as, fascists, as, Hitlerites, as anti-Semites, as militant right-wing kind of monsters from, the Second World War. And, of course, many who have defended the Maidan crowd and the new government in Kiev, including folks in Washington, have been completely dismissive of this claim. But in practice, I think, if one looks closely at the far-right scene in Ukraine and the role they played in the Maidan events and that they now play in parts of the Ukrainian government, I think there is cause for alarm for all of us. And I think it is striking that some of these groups have adopted almost, neo-Nazi symbols, neo-Nazi language, and much of that is troubling. I guess it's because, Putin has, of course, made, ridiculous claims about them, his defense of their opponents. We've been too quick to dismiss what actually is there. Because they do form part of a broader coalition with actors who are more, you know, amenable to Washington and to EU. But for my part, actually, I think I would be alarmed. I think there are people. I mean, it's not clear how many of these people will get ministerial positions, but you know, they formed some of the fighting brigades in Kiev, but they've been active and they've been clashing with ethnic Russians in eastern cities like Donetsk. And so, and then yeah, I know the chief rabbi of Ukraine made some statement to the effect that, you know, there is no anti-Semitism in Ukraine, which of course was a response to Putin's rhetoric, but that of course is ridiculous. But I think more generally, I mean, I think if, you know, if one looks at the history of Ukrainian nationalism and the history of various Ukrainian state-building efforts, it's impossible to enjoy. I mean, it's impossible to ignore the Jewish question. It's impossible to ignore how certain Ukrainian nationalist groups have defined themselves against Jews. I mean, that is very much part of the story, not all the story, but part of the story of Ukrainian nationalism. So I think that though we don't like to hear it from Putin's mouth because we object to his politics in so many other ways, it's worth our attention. It's worth thinking about, and I think that's something that Washington should have thought more about before rushing to kind of throw the mantle of approval over the new leaders of Kiev, you know, who immediately came to the fore when Yanukovych left. So that, unfortunately, I think, is a story that we'll have to tell in a way that doesn't, of course, affirm Putin's image of these people, right? I mean, one has to resist Putin's propaganda, but also recognize that there is a problem. There's a problem with the Ukrainian right, and I think it definitely has infected this new government. Though that complicates Washington's view of it, I think that's very much the reality on the ground, especially in some of these big cities where they are, you know, armed and potentially quite dangerous.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Sathpal Singh with State University of New York at Buffalo.
Hi, thanks for your presentation. And the current situation is obviously very delicate and has the potential to lead to violence. Is there anything that the interfaith community can do to lessen the tension, especially given the potential of some interreligious issues arising? There was an interfaith meeting scheduled in Kiev in about a couple of weeks, which has been postponed now. But given the situation, is there anything that the interfaith collaboration can achieve to decrease the tension there?
That's a wonderful suggestion. I wish I had a concrete plan to recommend. You know, one of the senior clerics in Ukraine, originally from Lebanon, spoke in the press more, I guess it was early this year, late last year. He made a very strong case for trying to remain apolitical, and he was critical of some Muslim groups who had joined one faction or another. I think there's much to admire in that. I mean, if groups could come together and create some alternative space in which it's not an either-or proposition, I think that would be welcome. And if one can think of concrete ways to have conversations to really talk about, you know, minority rights, talk about pluralism, all that, of course, would be wonderful. I fear at this particular moment it's a bit utopian because it seems to me that all these issues are so politicized. I mean, they're so extremely politicized by all sides. And, you know, the Kremlin itself has, I think, further politicized the Muslim institutions by sending these delegations from Tatarstan and elsewhere to attempt to, you know, win over the Crimean Tatars. So, no, I applaud your suggestion. I'm afraid I don't have a concrete see a concrete way forward, but I think there's potential. I think that, you know, and all this stuff, I think there is room for negotiation. I think that's actually what I imagine. I hope the Kremlin will take a deep breath now and that there will be some room for political discussions, and interfaith groups may actually play a very important role in that on the ground, especially in a place like Crimea, which is so mixed up. I think if there were a way to connect to local institutions there, that would be very fruitful ground.
And in fact, in particular, as you mentioned, seeing things as black and white leads to a lot of issues, and somebody has to bring up things in between those two extremes, and that can be really very helpful.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I guess, again, I think there are many, many villains in the story. And I think that the obviously the major one is sitting in Moscow, but I think, you know, I think the United States and the EU could have played a more constructive role. I think Ukrainian elites could have played, you know, a different role. So I think I applaud your suggestion. I hope that people will take it up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next comment or question.
Our next question comes from Maha Elgenandi with the Islamic Networks Group.
Hello, Dr. Cruz. I'm also a graduate student at Stanford University in Religious Studies, by the way.
Oh, great. Hi.
So I'm going to take you back a little bit, and I'm sorry that I arrived a little bit late for the conversation, but I'm really curious to find out how much of a role does religion really play in the Ukraine and Crimea in relation to Russia, and does it supersede other interests or sources of identity? And because you keep referring to the religion of the Tatars when you're talking about them, and I sort of quickly skimmed your article as you were talking, and I'm just wondering why we're doing that. Why are we referring to the religion of the Tatars as opposed to their ethnicity, or referring to them as an ethnic group that is much more impacted by their social, political, and economic position in the Ukraine, Crimea, Russia, because of their political history? And I'm not denying that Islam doesn't play a role in their community or in their group, but I would think that it probably plays as much of a role as Christianity might for many congressmen and women here in the United States who are motivated by their politics and interests much more than their religion. Religion plays a role in everybody's life, but why are we referring to the Tatars by their religion? And then as a general question, how much of a role does religion really play on the ground?
Okay, great. Thank you. Another excellent question. Yeah, I mean, I tend to foreground some of these issues because the actors foreground them. And I foreground them in other contexts because it's of interest to me. So, but I would wholeheartedly endorse your reminder that, yeah, these are complicated people whose lives are shaped by many different kinds of forces. So I don't mean to reduce them to any kind of flattened, single kind of monolithic Muslim identity by any means. I'm clearly ethnicity is very important. I mean, for the Crimean Tatars that I'm discussing today, the geography, the memory, the idea, the experience of expulsion under Stalin, those are all crucial. It just happens that some of them are mullahs. Some of them go to mosques. Some of them are, you know, they're members of, they see themselves as, they see Islam as part of their distinctive cultural heritage too. And so that's why there are, you know, there are tensions not just between Tatars and their neighbors in some cases, but among Tatars. So it matters whether one's from the Crimea or one's from Kazan or one's from Kiev, right? So I think these are all things that are important. I think there are differences among, you know, genders and class and livelihood and all these things that you would find geography in Crimea too. So I guess for our purposes, I don't know, maybe I should have laid this out more clearly at the beginning, but I guess one reason for me to foreground that today is because the Crimean Tatars are now the object of an integration campaign that the Kremlin is pursuing through Islamic institutions, through institutions that have that status in the Russian Federation that are, you know, clerical institutions, but which aspire to be, you know, they're kind of religious come political institutions. And naturally, people relate to them in different ways. People relate to them in all manner of ways. And, yeah, I mean, in the article that I wrote for Foreign Affairs, you know, on the one hand, I tried to address a lot of alarmism about Islam and the Russian Federation, you know, and then tried to contextualize that and show that, you know, if anything, if I can generalize, you know, these populations tend to be less religious than their Orthodox Christian neighbors. So, I mean, that's very hard to measure. I mean, there are, as you know from your background, they're not, in religious studies and other fields, they're not perfect ways to measure religiosity. What does that mean? And does it mean the same thing in one community as another? But by some of the indices that Russian social scientists have arrived at, you know, I mean, they're fairly sophisticated and they're mixed. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, again, I just endorse your reminder that these are complicated people, complicated times. And, yeah, I mean, these political actors act in different contexts, you know, in different ways. And I think the big question now that looms over the Crimean Tatar community is this question of their status under a Russian state that they tend to conflate with the Soviet Empire, that they tend to conflate with with Stalinism. I mean, when they look at Putin, may them see Stalin. And part of that might have a kind of religious flavoring, but in the end, I mean, the dominant Crimean Tatar discourse is nationalist. It's nationalist, you know, it's nationalist with a religious, you know, content, with some religious coloring, but it's not solely that, right? But there are also, you know, as in any community, there are some who would say, you know, they are Muslims first, Tatar second, right? So I don't mean to, it's very hard to convey this complexity in a short amount of time, but I think you're certainly right. These are communities that are internally diverse and quite complicated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *1. And our next question comes from John Denker with the United Religions Initiative.
Yes, thank you for being here. I was wondering, do you think Putin is going to make a move on eastern Ukraine? And what is the Muslim population of eastern Ukraine? What is the makeup, and how do they align themselves politically with Ukraine or with Russia?
Okay, thank you. If I may start with the last question, first, you know, there are in the major urban centers of eastern Ukraine, there are small Muslim populations. They tend to be of a kind of diasporic nature. A number of them come from the Volga River region. They're Tatars who migrated for labor purposes at various moments. Throughout Ukraine now, there are, you know, places like Kiev. These are global cities in a sense, and so they are they're part of the broader flow of labor from the south, from the Caucasus, from Central Asia. So they can be often quite diverse. What I understand of the Muslim populations in the eastern cities is that they tend to be, some of them tend to look more to Russia because they have family connections there, and they trace their roots not to Crimea but to the Volga. But having said that, I strongly doubt that Putin will make a move on eastern Ukraine. And again, I'm an historian. I'm not a good prognosticator at all. I don't really claim that as an area of expertise, but I can admit, you know, I didn't see the Crimean thing coming either, but I think that East Ukraine will be too complicated. It's too mixed up. There are not any of the same factors that would make that legitimate in even the eyes of the Russian leadership. And it could invite real, I mean, in some ways, Crimea was easy. I mean, the bases were there. People, in a sense, had to come off the base and put the flag down, and that was easily done. Eastern Ukraine would be a different proposition because of the very mixed-up ethnic, linguistic, and other profile. And it's not just Ukrainian Russian. I mean, there are people who are intermarried and mixed up, and it would put enormous stress on these mixed communities and on political loyalties. And it's not clear what Russia would gain. I mean, it would gain yet another rust belt. So I don't envision that. I think Putin has made his point. I think part of the point was about, you know, making a point to the Russian public, to the elite, and then the other audience was the world and the United States. I think that he's made that point now, and I'm not sure if there's anything more to be said at this stage that moving into eastern Ukraine would do that he hasn't already managed with Crimea. So, thank you.
Of course, if he took eastern Ukraine, he might permanently lose western Ukraine to the EU and to NATO.
True, that's a great point. That's possible, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Sheikh Ubaid with the Muslim Peace Coalition.
Thank you for taking my question. Just like we were surprised because we were not expecting it, there's a rising nationalism and also religious feeling in the Orthodox leadership. Do you foresee Russia trying to take similar steps both in the Baltics and also in Central Asia? And were you also surprised by India standing with Russia like in the Cold War time, even though India has moved so much closer to the U.S.?
Oh, thank you for your question. You know, I hope I'm not being too optimistic, but I don't see any further Russian moves into former Soviet territory anywhere, really. It's hard to imagine. I mean, Central Asia presents lots of problems. one has to ask what was to be gained by doing that. It's hard to see. I mean, regionally, it's interesting that Russia has played such a complicated role with respect to Central and South Asia, especially in connection to the American war in Afghanistan. I mean, Russia has made enormous concessions and has facilitated transport at moments that were actually crucial when the pipeline, rather when the corridor through Pakistan collapsed at various moments, Russia helped fill that void. And actually, this will be even more important going forward. I mean, if the United States withdraws from Afghanistan completely in 2014 or at the end of the year, for NATO as well, I mean, there's still a lot of equipment to remove, and there's still a lot of open questions about what that will look like regionally, with India, Pakistan, and the Central Asian states. So, I mean, the United States and Russia share a common security interest in Central Asia, but it's been interesting to watch moments of tension, but also cooperation between Russia and the United States in and around Afghanistan. Russia is critical of the drug trade, but has been pretty permissive about permitting infrastructural projects and permitting resupply lines and so on. But as far as a broader global reorientation for Russia with respect to India or other states, it's hard to imagine that. The Orthodox Church is a kind of font of national sentiment in Russian society. But as I noted earlier, I think in response to another question, I think it's more diverse internally than it may look from outside. And so one of the questions to think about in the future will be, to what degree this is sustainable, to what degree this national resurgence is actually manageable. I mean, even in Russian cities, places like Moscow, there are enormous migrant populations, right? And you have a growing problem of racism. I mean, there are lots of things that Russia has to deal with that kind of collapse the internal, external, domestic foreign policy divides. And you have, vast numbers, for example, of Tajiks, right, living in Moscow. You have perhaps several million Muslims and others living in Moscow. So the whole problem of tolerance, diversity, pluralism is something that is very much, a core domestic issue in Russian society. And the Orthodox Church will have to, I think, will resolve that. I mean, the Orthodox Church will have to resolve its positions on those views. And I think, here, going back to another question, this may provide some space for some kind of interfaith dialogue. Because even the Russian Muslim clergy is also very concerned, of course, with their co-religionists and how they're treated at work sites and markets. And, they make up a significant underclass in places like Moscow and St. Petersburg. And so there's a lot of room. I mean, there's a lot of room for the Russian state to invest in the stability of these areas, especially when there's a state now that is part of global migration labor markets, and it needs stability at home just as it needs stability abroad. So thank you for your question.
Thank you. I think we should, looking at the time, I think we are at the end of our time, unfortunately, but I think this has been a terrific call, and Bob, we really appreciate your sharing your insights with us
today. Thank you. Great. Thank you. No, it's been fun.
It has been great, and we look forward to continuing to see your analysis of the issue.
Great.
As I said, I hope that you will visit CFR.org and foreignaffairs.com for further analysis and insights from both CFR fellows and experts such as Bob, who hails from Stanford University. So thank you all. Our next conference call will take place on April 2nd. Brian Grimm, president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, will discuss how religious hostilities around the world have reached a six-year high. So I hope you all join us for that. We will be sending a special invitation. Please email us at outreach@cfr.org with any suggestions or topics you would like to see in future conference calls, and we look forward to your continued participation.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.